and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, our series of lectures from the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference concludes with two presentations. In the first half of today's show, hear from horticultural agent and educator with the UAF Cooperative Extension Service in Anchorage, Julie Riley, on the culture of gardening. And in the second half of today's show, we'll move over to Verna Pratt's presentation on growing wildflowers in the home. Both lectures were recorded at the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference held at the UAA APU Consortium Library on March 12th. Now, Julie Riley on the culture of gardening.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Julie Riley, and I have worked for Cooperative Extension Service for 30 years. I started working for Cooperative Extension Service back in 1981, and this was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I worked with Shoots and Roots Urban Garden Program. And this is where I first learned that gardening is cultural, and it's taken me 30 years, you know, to put together a talk to kind of address this whole idea. I went to the big city. I grew of Milwaukee. I grew up in a small town of 1,000 people, all Caucasian. You know, the only differences were between the Catholics and the Lutherans. So it was a pretty homogeneous group. I went to the big city and I discovered neighborhoods. And in Milwaukee is set up with lots of different of ethnic neighborhoods. And so it was really, really fascinating. But as you know, a young woman in my 20s. I get to the garden and learn that people that I'm teaching to garden don't know what broccoli is. And I am just amazed. How can you not know what broccoli is? But it wasn't too long before I learned that I did not know what collards were. So, you know, a lot of the gardeners that we were working with were from the southern United States, and, you know, they had just grown up with different vegetables. So that was very enlightening. Back in about 1981, Milwaukee got a big influx of Hmong refugees, and they raised some of the same crops that the African-American gardeners from the South raised, mustard being one, and there was a little bit of a standoff here as to who was the good gardener and who was not, you know, following proper gardening practices, because when mustard started to go to seed, you know, the southern gardeners would pull it out and plant another crop. When the Hmong mustard started to go to seed, the Hmong gardeners ate the expanding shoots. They let some of it go to seed so that they could, you know, dry the pods and collect the seed, because they had brought the seed with them. You know, it was before 9/11, so they brought the seed with them, you know, from their countries, and were continuing to plant that. So the other thing that I learned was that cilantro, which I really never developed a taste for, but one of my colleagues was a Puerto Rican woman who had to have cilantro in absolutely everything that she cooked. And so she taught me how to grow it. You know, the seeds that come in little balls, and there's more than one seed, and you roll it in your hands, and you seed it, and she always kept some fresh. And when you went to her house, you always had to eat. You just had to eat, and it always had cilantro. Well, when the Hmong refugees showed up, they also used cilantro. So this idea that, you know, I don't know why, you know, as growing up in small town Wisconsin, why I didn't think that, you know, your food is based on who you are and what your parents teach you and the customs of your community. But it was a revelation, and it's been something that I have enjoyed ever since. So with that, I'm going to kind of get things rolling here. So you are what you eat. Have you ever heard that? So many of our mothers told us you are what you eat when they tried to get us to eat our vegetables. But really, the way you eat is because of who you are. And what you grow and how you grow it are related to your culture. So culture, if you think about it, there are two meanings. One has to do with customs, dress, food, and religion. But if you were reading a gardening book, you might find a section titled culture that would give you the instructions on how to grow a crop. So only, you know, certain cultures, people from certain cultures could get excited about having, you know, freshly harvested Brussels sprouts for Thanksgiving dinner, you know, in Alaska. So if we look at this word culture, there, if you go onto the internet, there are these word clouds that group different meanings of words and the words, the etiology of the words. And if we look at culture, we find a grouping that has to do with growth and growing. We have another group that has to do with civilization, and another area that has to do with cultivation. So I just was tickled, you know, when I realized that we've got the culture of people, but we also have the culture, meaning that the care that we need to give for a particular plant. Okay, there is a Japanese farmer, Masanobu Fukioka, who was really quite the Renaissance man. He was a scientist, a writer, artist, philosopher, and one of his most well-known books is called The One Straw Revolution. He has a saying that gardening is not just the cultivation of plants, it's also the cultivation of human beings. There's a fabulous book called The Hungry Planet that was published in 2005. It's by Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, where they went to 24 countries and selected a family and sat down and ate with them, and then and had the family compile a week's worth of food. I have some of those photographs. They took this pieces of this book and put it into a curriculum for social studies class, and because I work for the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service, we have a program where we work with low-income people trying to help them stretch their food dollar. So the first country that I wanted to look at was Bhutan, which is a very mountainous country in the Himalayas where most families practice subsistence agriculture. So here's one family. I think there I counted 13 people, and the food that they have to eat does not look like a lot. There's a big sack of rice, and this family eats 70 pounds of rice per week. So that is a main part of their diet. The chili peppers are very important to them, and they consider it to be a vegetable rather than just a condiment, and they eat these chili peppers with every meal. And when they have a problem with crop failure because of pest problems, and they have to grow it, they have to take the money out of somewhere else in their budget in order to buy their chilies. And the particular family that was featured in The Hungry Planet, the text talks about how they had to take the money out of school supplies and school uniforms so that they could buy their chilies when they had crop failure. This family also grows mustard, and I talked about mustard a little bit earlier, but what they were doing with the mustard is growing it for its seed so that they could press the seed for oil, and that is their source of cooking oil. So we have people from different cultures who are using the same plant in three different ways here. So in Anchorage, Alaska, last year in 2010, we have a number of Bhutanese refugee gardeners that have moved here. They are Nepali-speaking people, and they gardened in Mountain View and sold the crops that they grew at farmers' markets. So I didn't have an opportunity to work with them real closely because I had a VISTA volunteer this last year, but This year, now that I've learned a little bit more about Bhutan, I'll find out if they have some of the similar customs that the Bhutanese had. Okay, we're going to move now to Guatemala, to Central America. And about 66% of the Central American country's population is indigenous. And the family that was featured in Hungry Planet was quite a well-off family. They have lots of fresh vegetables, nice big, you know, carrots, lots of ripe red tomatoes, cabbages and potatoes and rice and even some chickens in a pot. Moving down a little bit farther south to Ecuador, this country sits on the equator and is very mountainous. And because of the high altitude, much of the country is not in the best, or does not have the best climate and growing conditions to grow vegetables. So this is a family, and the amount of food that they are eating in a week's time looks a little bit sparser, you know, than their counterpart in Guatemala here. And they have plantains and bananas and some carrots and leeks, cabbages, and a big portion of their diet, or the starch in their diet, comes from potatoes. And this particular family, and there are nine people, are eating 100 pounds of potatoes a week, which is a lot of potatoes. So we're back in Anchorage now, where I have a family that I have befriended who are from the Congo. And they eat a lot of potatoes too. I was just amazed, you know, when I went to their house, and what they would be having for supper was just a great big pile of potatoes, you know, with a few tomatoes thrown in. So, of course, but there are other crops that they had grown back in the Congo and back in Uganda, where they'd been in refugee camps, that they cannot grow here, unless, of course, you are one of the contenders in the Palmer State Fair who grows the large pumpkins. You know, I had to tell them, you know, you can't grow tomatoes, you know, you can't grow pumpkins, you can't grow too many winter squash. And then I take them to the Palmer Fair and they see a 100-pound pumpkin, you know. And so this, Oliver is 22 years old, and he wanted this picture on his Facebook page, you know, because he was really impressed and wanted to show, you know, people back in his country, you know, that we had huge pumpkins here. Okay, into Africa, Central Africa, one of the countries that was featured in Hungry Planet is Chad. Chad is near the Sudan, and because of the strife and war in Sudan, has a number of refugee families. And the refugee families in Chad, are, as in many parts of the world, are very dependent on food from international aid agencies. And so this, the family of six here that's featured in Hungry Planet, they, you know, they have a bag of rice, and they have some little dried vegetables, and they do have some fresh limes. But if you, you know, if you think about what the growing conditions are, it's in a the refugee camp is in a desertous location, and so it's very difficult for them to grow their own food. Now back to my family that I met here in Anchorage, in Uganda. Their grandmother actually was able to finagle a place to grow some of the family's vegetables. So being able to, you know, provide food for your family is important, but there seems to be a very strong, you know, correlation between wealth and subsistence and some of the other countries in the healthy or the Hungry Planet show this difference. So we're going to move on to China, which is a rapidly urbanizing country, and even, you know, since the Hungry Planet has been published in 2005, there are still many areas that are very agricultural. although the villagers are now enjoying some modern conveniences. So the family that is featured, the food that they have been eating for a week, you know, shows a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, eggs, grains, a little bit of corn. So, but they're only growing about 10% of what they're eating each year, and they have a farm where they grow barley, wheat, soybeans, and peanuts, but they also are doing more urban gardening, where in a courtyard in their kitchen they're growing grapes, tomatoes, cabbage, squash, and cucumbers. And even though they grow corn, they're not eating very much corn in a week. They are trading their corn for other items. But they are very good at not wasting their food, and use corn husks to feed their sheep, and they take the corn leaves and weave them into cushions and feed scraps to the cats. And so they're using a much larger percentage of the food that is grown, so that nothing goes to waste. So bringing him back home again, this is Tina Kuo. She's my roommate, and she is from Taiwan. So Taiwan is a little tiny island country that is off the coast of China. It's still separate from China, although it may not be for much longer. And I was telling her about this talk that I was going to be giving, and she mentioned that in her culture they ate the leaves and the shoots of the sweet potato plant. And I'd never heard this before. So she provided me some information. You know, I was used to sweet potatoes as a southern crop back when I worked in Milwaukee. You know, we grew sweet potatoes here in Alaska and Anchorage. I've had master gardeners grow sweet potatoes in the greenhouse.
Oh, that was too cold to grow.
Yeah, or maybe as, you know, just getting the roots to sprout, you know, as a activity for kids. But now we even have all these new cultivars of sweet potatoes that we're growing as ornamental plants. So we've got different cultures with different uses of the same plant, and I think this is what makes it so much fun to meet other people in the world, is just to see how they are utilizing plants that you grow yourself. So the Cook Inlet Bonsai Study Group, three men went to Vietnam just in January, and then they are sharing some of their images with me. Once we get into rice production, we're usually looking at a much larger scale of agriculture than what we would call home gardening. And some of the unusual vegetables and fruits that they were able to see there was the dragon fruit, which it looks like the Agricultural Research Service in this country is doing a bit of work on, but it's a beautifully colorful fruit that is very tasty. And so they would see big patches of it as they would go on tour looking for their bonsai plants. So some of the pictures of Vietnam that Tim Pack and Paul Mormora have shared with me. Vietnam, the hillsides are terraced and gardened, and I guess what was one of the things that was really striking to the visitors was the fact that there was so much being grown under plastic or under glass, and that you would see greenhouses that were terraced down hillsides and down valleys. But here in the middle of the city was a farmer who just lived by his hut, you know, in the midst of all the modernization, and had his farm fields and his livelihood the way he did before things got really modernized. And one of the things that they pointed out to me is that the country grew quite a bit of coffee. And Paul Mormora shared the fact, or shared some of his Vietnamese coffee with me. He says it tastes like chocolate, and said that people also drink tea, but they are very heavy coffee drinkers as well, you know, which we tend to think of Asian cultures as being more oriented to utilizing tea. So the coffee, the way they were growing the coffee was to grow it, you know, up into the woods. So here you can kind of see it in rows, but it does go up into the woods. Okay, Kuwait, maybe the last country that I'm going to share with you what a week's worth of food looks like. And they are a very tiny country that's oil rich and has a very high standard of living. And when you take a look at a week's worth of food for this family, it's a family of six, and then they have a couple of servants that have come from outside the country looking for work. So the food that they have, you see some of the brands that we have in this country, you can kind of pick them out. So they really are, because of the environmental conditions in the country being very arid and with poor soils, they are importing about 98% of their food. And so this kind of made me think of Alaska as an importer of its food. And I don't know if we really know how much food is being imported, but
95%.
Yeah, that you hear 95%, and it could even be more. So Jill Shepherd, who spoke earlier in the day about the traditions, the cultures that Alaska Native communities has, we have a tendency to think of them as a hunting and gathering society. And I had always thought that it was the missionaries that had introduced gardening to them. But evidence is now showing that, you know, 250 years earlier, the peoples were raising crops. The first Russian colony in Alaska, the first deliberate Russian colony in Alaska at Three Saints Bay, so the Russian helped to introduce, you know some of the vegetables that are grown today by Native Alaskans, cabbage and turnips and potatoes and rutabagas. And then one of the plants that Lenore Hedla had in one of her books on Alaska gardening from 1974 talks about how comfrey had been around so long that the islanders were now calling it Russian comfrey. So I am fortunate to have a collection of photos from Christine Heller, who traveled and worked in Alaska in the 40s and the 50s. And she had taken pictures of large gardens in the interior of Alaska. This is Tetlin, where we see a gentleman with a hide pinned on the, or tacked to the side of his house, standing in front of a big field of potatoes. And then another image from an Alaskalite from 1947 that had belonged to Christine Heller. So having to, you become a gardener out of necessity if you want fresh fruits and vegetables. And some of these gardens were very large indeed. So the archaeological evidence has shown that there were potatoes that were perhaps traded up and down the western coast by the Alaska natives. And we have the Tlingit potato, which has received a lot of press this last summer. The Jensen Olson Arboretum, which is on Carolyn Jensen's property down in, was Carolyn Jensen's property that she bequeathed to the city of Juneau, where they involved school kids at raising this heritage potato, which was a white potato, kind of lumpy, and that has been passed down from generation to generation for many years. so there is a strong tradition of raising potatoes in the some of the Alaskan bush communities. The pictures that I'm showing you here show kids having fun with their potato harvest in Galena, and then a huge turnip that is being exhibited by Gracie Thomas at the Fort Yukon Agricultural Fair just this last year. And then we have our Matanuska colonists, and this, you know, the colonists were part of our history in Alaska. When back during the Depression, the United States decided to, they hand selected about 200 people or 200 families, 200 families, to come to Alaska, clear land, and put that land into production. And they didn't have a very, the expectation was that within a year, they would be fully functioning. And it tickles me, when going back and reading some of the books and looking at the videos of the time, that one of the first crops that was sold, by the colonists were raspberries. So that's a great horticultural crop. They weren't the wild raspberries, but a cultivated raspberry that one of the farm families brought to the state.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Julie Riley from the UAF Cooperative Extension Service in Anchorage. Her talk on the culture of gardening was recorded at the Alaska Botanical 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference on Saturday, March 12th. Now we'll move on to the last and final presentation recorded at the Garden Conference with Verna Pratt, renowned naturalist and respected authority on Alaska native plants and wildflowers. Verna Pratt gave her talk on growing wildflowers in the home garden.
Most people, when they think of what they want to grow in the garden, is what they see in an alpine meadow. And what you really want is an alpine meadow without the grass, because an alpine meadow has grass. And naturally, you don't want that in your yard, because the grass will take over. Like I said, the strong guys win. So you have to modify what you really want to do. And one of the things you see in alpine meadows is wild geranium. Wild geranium is easy to grow, both from seed or from young transplants. They're easy to find in plant sales. I'll get from free from a friend. Normally they're lavender, but sometimes you see white ones. And if you're growing both in your yard, they may hybridize, which means that your lavender ones are going to look like they're kind of faded a bit after a while. So you may want to kind of prune out the ones who you don't really like the color of. And this is so, let's face it, in any kind of gardening, sometimes you have to get rid of the ones that are not the choices. It depends upon what you want. And they'll grow in sun, they'll grow in shade, almost total shade, actually. The amount of moisture is not too critical with them. So they really are a great one, except they could become a pest. They could become almost a weed because they reseed so well. So it's up to you. Yeah, I mean, you have to do deadheading if you want to keep them under control and only have enough plants that you want. You can make a specimen plants into it and just keep all the others out. You know, it's just up to you how you handle it and your situation in your yard. Yeah. This is monkshood. Monkshood is an easy one to transplant. They will reseed in your yard, but not heavily. They seem to need to go through stratification, which is cold and warm treatments, which happens naturally in the wild. So I germinate them outside. Just let the seeds sprinkle where they are, and that works about the best. And they can be anywhere from 2 feet to 4 feet tall, depending upon where you are. And sometimes up in the alpine, they're less than a foot tall. It just depends upon situations. They're a real easy one, but never a pest, for sure. And usually the dark blue. Occasionally I see a white one, but it's very, very rare. And like I said, easy to take care of, which is a real blessing. And we have the tall Jacob's ladder there. which is real easy to take care of. You see them at plant sales. You also see them in the nurseries. They may not be the same species, subspecies in the nurseries, but they're going to look so much like it, it's going to be difficult to tell them apart. But they'll work. The other is Iris setosa, and iris are best just getting divisions from somebody. They will grow from seed, but it takes 3 or 4 years before they amount to anything. So they're really, really slow, and you can grow those almost anywhere. This is blue-eyed grass, which is related to the iris. This is only about 6 inches tall, 6 or 8 inches tall. This one also can be a pest because it reseeds so well. So you may want to do a little deadheading. It's about 6 inches tall and really a cute little guy. And that shows you the full plant and the flower by itself. It's really quite a cute little guy.
Which one did you say this was from?
Sorry?
Which one is
Blue-eyed grass. And I only put the common name there because every other time when I give the scientific and the common, it's pretty complicated for people. And I found that the majority of people really want the common name. What's your feelings here? Common name, hands up?
Common name. Okay.
If you do want the scientific name, I'll give them to you, but otherwise I won't. We'll see what happens this time.
We can look that up.
Yeah. This is the chocolate lily bulb at the bottom. And you can't see very well here, but this is a main bulb with a bunch of baby bulbs attached to it. One of the best ways of getting that to propagate is to dig it up in either in the fall or real early in the spring and pull those little baby bulbs off. As long as they're attached to the mother bulb, they won't try to do anything. And you can get them to grow and become mature plants real fast by detaching them. Much better than growing it from seed. If they're grown from seed, you have to stratify them. That means put them outside and let them go through the cold and warm treatments. And this is a favorite of most people because it's real pretty. This is Mertensia or bluebells. And this is an easy one, tolerates shade or sun. Either way, it'll do just fine. It does some reseeding, not tremendous, but some. This is the Erigeron leafy aster. This actually is one to watch. I have it in my yard. When I saw it growing in the wild, I fell in love with the color of it. I mean, it was just outstanding color. And I got the seeds, and then I found out. It spreads. So you do have to control it. I put it in a place in my garden where I can dig around the edges without it getting into other things. I purposely left space around it because I do like it. But you also have to deadhead it. You absolutely have to. It reseeds too well. But deadheaded, it is beautiful for a long period of time. It's much prettier than the Siberian aster, and it's taller. It's about knee high. So I do support it with a little fencing around it. And I really like it, but you do have to watch it. This is the Alaska violet. This is another one you usually find in alpine meadows underneath the other plants. It's a really nice little plant. I suspect it needs stratification for seeds to germinate. And it does not germinate plentifully and for some reason. But it is really one of the nicest violets there is. I know we're missing one other one in between there. This is the columbine, the western columbine. A super easy one to grow from seed. And you see them show up at plant sales, which really makes it really nice. Color ranges from red to orange with a yellow center. And there is a little lavender one here, but you seldom see it at sales. And it's not near as impressive as the red columbine. However, if you have other columbines in your yard, these could hybridize with them. Yeah. The columbines are real promiscuous plants, and they are horrible about. And when you find it with the long spurs, really, really long spurs on the back, you know it's hybridized with something else. So the color will vary after a while. What I do is grow fresh ones from seed every few years, just to get something that looks kind of true to what it's supposed to be. This is Shooting Star, and this is the Shooting Star that's up in the Klutna Flats. There are four different varieties in Alaska, actually five. And depending on where you are, there will be a different one showing up. Mostly what you find at plant sales or from seed is this particular one. It's this one called Superbum, which means pretty, superb or whatever. And it gets to be almost 14 to 16 inches tall, whereas the other subspecies, Alaskanum, is shorter. And I personally like it better, but it's more compact and slightly different leaves, but I have trouble telling the difference in the spring before they actually bloom. The leaves are not too much different from the other ones, so it is difficult to tell. Any of the Shooting Stars are nice, as long as you give them ample moisture. They normally grow in damp areas, so just make sure you give them ample moisture and let them reseed on their own, yes.
When do they come out on the flats? I've driven out there many a times looking for them.
Mid-June.
And have missed them.
Mid-June. About
so they're before the iris or after?
Just about the same time. Maybe slightly before. Maybe slightly before. Well, you might not be quite in the right area. Since the earthquake and the tidal, the water came in, things have changed there quite a bit as to where things are growing. The Shooting Stars aren't right with the iris. They're kind of closer back toward the bushes more. So maybe you just haven't quite hit the right place because they're about the same time. This is the Shooting Star from Jeffreyi from Southeast Alaska. And as you can see, it looks similar. The leaves are slightly different. It doesn't have the yellow band next to the white. Yeah, that's Frigida on the other side. It also does not have a yellow band on it, but the leaves are a different shape. And so, basically, they're very similar, and growing conditions are about the same.
Does it always grow in a group like that, you said?
Almost all the Shooting Stars grow in a group like that. Frigidum tends to be a more northern one, and it tends to be a little shorter than the others. Jeffreyi, it depends upon the habitat where it grows, what it actually looks like. And there you see on the left is a planting of them down at the home of the Pratt Museum. And I think that's a good way to display Shooting Stars in a bunch like that, rather than single plants. They actually look better. This is Monkey Flower, or Wild Snapdragon. It likes really wet areas. However, it'll tolerate growing in your yard. And I do have a small pond. I don't like to put it near the pond because it grows too robust and falls over and it looks messy. So I keep it away from the water, actually, even though that's its natural place to grow. And it's about a foot or so high and really attractive, and it's an edible plant. You can eat the leaves like you would in a salad or like you would cook it like spinach. So it's a multi-use plant. And I don't find it objectionable. It's supposed to be a perennial, but it doesn't seem to last as one in our climate. I suspect we're maybe just a little bit too cool for it. So it tends to die out and reseed, which kind of keeps it under control. This particular valerian I like better than the Sitka valerian, which you see in alpine meadows. This one's shorter. It's only about 14 inches tall. Has real pretty maroon-colored buds, then moves into pink, and eventually almost white as it matures. And it will tolerate almost total shade. And that's mostly because it wants moisture. And so therefore the shade gives it that more of a chance of having a lot of moisture. I have it on the north side of my house where it only gets sun just for about an hour in the morning. And that's all. And that's all it needs. It's never become aggressive. It does spread slowly, but it's very, very slowly. I can't imagine it ever being a problem for anybody. And it should have a nice smell to it. That one's not flipping again. That's the red stem saxifrage. All of the saxifrages are nice in your garden. There's no question about it. Saxifrages are a nice plant. They mostly have leaves near the base, and then tall stems with little flowers on them. Usually the flowers are kind of small, but there's usually a cluster of them. This particular one has real bright red stems on it. It grows right in the streams. But I have found on the north side of the house where the moisture hangs in there longer, it does just fine. And it does spread by itself and becomes just a bigger mat. The one on the left is the brook saxifrage. And it has larger leaves, and I don't let it near the pond either, mainly because it just gets too big. It's too happy there, and it doesn't look nice. It looks nicer when it's left small. In the wild, it doesn't grow that way. When you bring things to your yard, they're not necessarily going to be the same as what you saw in the wild. They usually alter them by quite a bit. The one on the left is your stream violet, little yellow violet. And as pretty as it is, I would recommend growing it as a border, a place where you can do the same thing you do with the aster, is keep cutting it back, keep it under control, because it will take over. But it is a real pretty little yellow violet. This is Roman Zoffia. This is Miss Maiden. And this is Roman Zoff's Miss Maiden. These are starting to show up at plant sales. This is a plant that until 2-3 years ago you never saw at a plant sale. It looks like a saxifrage, frequently mistaken for a saxifrage because it's so similar. And it by its name, the Miss Maiden tells you something. It grows next to waterfalls or right in the edge of streams. But it will tolerate your garden as long as you give it enough moisture, and it doesn't require a tremendous amount. They're quite happy little plants. There's two varieties of it, that one and the Sitka Miss Maiden over on the left. And as you can see, this one has the flowers kind of spaced out more. They're not in the tight clump. Both of these are from farther south than we are. I think Portage is the farthest north either one of them gets, and they tend to grow around Prince William Sound where they get a lot of moisture. But they do tolerate a yard, and they grow super easy from seed. It's surprising how many of these plants grow easy from seed once you know what their conditions are. And I'm a person who likes to grow things from seed, especially in the winter. I have plant stand with lights in the house, so I can start seeds in the fall. And that way, by the time spring comes along or summer comes along, you've had 6 months of growth. So you've given these plants almost 2 years of growth inside, so that by the time they go out, they're a good-sized plant. And it also a much stronger plant for it. So you have a better chance of these little seedlings surviving with that much time ahead. Plus, it doesn't take them so long to decide to bloom when they've had that much time. Other people sometimes just sow the seeds in a large bucket. Outside or a large plant pot, a very large plant pot, like a 12 to 16 inch plant pot, and let them do their thing out there, which is fine, it works. But they don't get the individual attention they do inside. They don't get steady watering, which is kind of important for little seedlings. It just depends upon how much time you have and how much, where you want the process of growing things from seed to be in your lifestyle. This is bog rosemary on this side. Bog rosemary is a little pink shrub. Definitely needs to be planted next to a pool where you can, where it's going to constantly get moisture. But it does fine. Thanks, Carmel. And it does fine in your yard. And about the only place you're going to find that is a plant rescued from an area that's being destroyed or from some of the nurseries. They are now bringing in bog rosemary. However, it may not be our species. Yes?
Can you cook with it?
Cook with it? Oh, yes, that's a really good question. She asked if you can cook with bog rosemary. I hope not. I hope you don't. It's called rosemary because it looks like rosemary. Bog rosemary has been used medicinally. It lowers your blood pressure. And it'll lower it all the way if you take the wrong amount. A common names are bad sometimes. They're easy to remember and people can relate to them, but they really are bad sometimes because they could really give you the complete wrong impression about a plant, obviously, from that one. And I'm glad you brought that up because I had forgotten about mentioning that. This is mountain marigold, which is related to marsh marigold, which people sometimes grow in the yard. This one's found in alpine streams or along the edges of ponds up in the alpine, but it will tolerate growing in your yard. Best in a place where it's going to get moisture, like the north side of your house or whatever, but it doesn't have to be. It will tolerate other places in your yard. It's a relative of the marsh marigold, which grows right in the water, in low elevations usually. And this one happens to be in a home pond, and it's in a pot. I grow all of my things in my pond in a pot, so I can control them. I'm not a control freak, but I like to see things look halfway nice, not get messy, but yet happy because they're getting the right amount of moisture or whatever they need. And it does require a lot of moisture. And these sometimes show up at plant sales. Both of them sometimes do. It just depends upon the particular year. The one you see over on the left is the bog bean, or buck bean. And as you can see, it's growing right in the water. Sometimes you see it in bogs alongside the boggy area, but usually it's right in water, at least some part of the year. It has three parted leaves. It has little clusters of flowers up on top that are fringed. They're really delightful little flowers, and they smell heavenly. But the only place you want to grow this is in a pond. It really needs that wet, but it makes a nice, I'll show you a picture of a pond later with some of these things in it. This is the wild calla lily. My little pond is really too small for this. It's only about 20 inches deep, and it's about 9 feet long and about 4 feet wide at the widest point. And it really is too shallow, I believe, for this to survive. It survives maybe for 2 or 3 years, and then it dies out. So I've stopped growing it. It really should be where it has more depth and a bigger pond. It could become an aggressive weed if you're not careful. Yes?
Excuse me, question on the bog bean. Where is that found?
The bog bean, where is it found? It's in Anchorage, in wet areas, sometimes near bogs. I've seen it. Are you from Anchorage? I've seen it over east of Muldoon Road and all those boggy areas next to the military land. And I've seen it in some other bogs in town. You might even see it alongside of a little stream. And it has three potted leaves. And sometimes it shows up at plant sales, but rarely. Just depends upon if somebody's going to divide it. And it's easy enough to divide. You just have to take a piece of the root and...
Is it an early bloomer?
Yes, it's very early bloomer. It blooms probably early June. The marsh marigold about the same time, maybe slightly before. But it really is a wonderful plant if you can come across a piece of a root from it. I sometimes divide mine in the spring. It just depends on how busy I am. On the right is tufted loosestrife, another native, which you rarely see, and I'm surprised now that I've found out what a weed it can be. I love the plant, not for the flowers particularly, but for the structure of the plant. Sometimes the structure of something or the leaves means more than anything else. These are clusters of very tiny flowers. They spread by rhizomes. Now, like I said, everything in my pond is in a pot, so I can control that. Except I forgot that every spring I clean out my pond. I throw the water out and whatever, and in the water sometimes the little pieces of this rhizome will be. And I found it growing in my flower beds, completely out of the water, and it's just as happy out of the water as it was in the water. So I have to pull them when I find them growing in my flower gardens, because otherwise it could be very, very destructive in your garden, I'm sure. So you do have to watch out for it, but it is pretty when it's growing in a pond. And over on the left, you see that's a bit of a pond. It has the tufted loosestrife in the middle, and that's probably about early July, I would think, from the size of it. And there's little bits of other plants there. By the end of the summer, that pond is almost completely covered with plants. You can hardly see the water at all. But it harbors fish in there, which is good. The fish have to be brought into the house in the winter. On the right here is the dwarf water lily. And I don't know if anybody's producing that anymore. Somebody was growing them from seed. It's only good, though, if you've got at least 30 inches of water in your pond. I don't grow it at all because I only have 20 inches. It won't survive, so there's no point. On the left is what is welcome to your yard when you have a pond. Birds. Why you do these things, I like the plants there, but I like some fish in the pond to make it natural. And I like to attract the birds to my yard. And that's really kind of important about what you're growing, whether you're attracting birds or not. Now we're switching to the dry land plants. This, look at how dry and gravelly this is. This is frigid arnica, arnica frigida. It loves it there. And it probably likes the lack of competition. That's part of why things grow sometimes in an area like this. When it does, that one isn't flipped. There is arnica in the frigida in the wild, the frigid arnica in the wild. And you see, it's much happier in the gravel. Much happier. So these are plants for a gravelly area. So you have to consider, what are you aiming for? What are you going to provide for these plants? This plant is being offered a lot. I know that Jaime Rodriguez was growing it from seed. He's had quite a few of those through the years. They are a heat-seeking plant. They face the sun or a hot rock. They don't care which it is, as long as it gives them heat so they can produce their seeds. That plant was a little confused that day. And over here on the right is another place of where arnica is happy, growing out of the side of a rock. It doesn't really care. But it would care if you made it too wet. So you would have to be careful where you plant it. On the left is passiflower. As it first comes up in the spring. And when you see a plant covered with hairs like that, that tells you a lot. First of all, first thing in the spring, the sun's kind of hot on those new little things. They're trying to protect themselves from the heat. The hairs kind of deflect the sun rays. Also, it traps moisture. So they're usually plants that are found in real wet areas, dry areas that you see the hairs on them. When it develops farther along, it'll have beautiful flowers. Passiflower, P-A-S-Q-U-E. It's also called crocus, spring crocus, because it looks a bit like a crocus, except it's hairy and crocus aren't. As it gets older, it becomes a huge clump, and mostly they're lavender, but occasionally you see other colors. I have one that saw one time, this beautiful light blue, and there it is, beautiful color blue. I've never seen it again. I would love to get some seeds from it, but never seen it. And it also produces these beautiful seed heads. So it doesn't matter. And passiflower is one that is best sown immediately. Take the seeds and plant them right away. And they'll do better than any other way. There's a lot of those available through nurseries. But they won't be our native, but they'll be very similar. And they'll be rose-colored. And they are really easier to grow than our native one. For some reason, I don't know why. On the right is low Jacob's ladder, or a beautiful Jacob's ladder. This is a real easy one to grow from seed. And it'll tolerate almost any conditions. But naturally, it grows in dry areas. This is Rigeron cespitosa, tufted fleabane. This is one from interior Alaska, and you didn't see it seed or otherwise in this area until a few years ago. I came across some seeds and grew them from seed, and they have done very well. And I have plants from time to time, and I definitely will have seeds again. And speaking of seeds, out on my table out there, I have seeds of from the Native Plant Society that they collect seeds each year and sell them for a very reasonable rate. I have some of last year's seeds and some of this year's seeds out there, and I also have seeds from the Rock Garden Society and of this year's seeds. And don't be afraid of last year's seeds. Generally speaking, most of them are okay. If they were ones that wouldn't germinate, I feel they wouldn't germinate, I took them out. Some seeds are definitely better the first year, and some sometimes do better the second year. That arnica that I showed you is best sown the very first year. If you wait beyond maybe March or April, after they developed the year before, they probably won't germinate for you at all. Whereas some of the others do far better on the second year. It's kind of a trial and error, and sometimes on the net you can find out some of this information, but some of it's just trial and error. Okay. Well, thanks for coming.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Verna Pratt, garden writer and respected authority on Alaska Native plants and wildflowers. Her talk on growing wildflowers in the home garden was recorded at the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference on Saturday, March 12th. This week concludes our three-part series on gardening on Addressing Alaskans. If you missed the show on April 7th with Danny Constantine on strengthening Alaska's local food systems, or if you missed Jeff Lowenfels on teeming with microbes, just go to KSKA.org and search Addressing Alaskans. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at KSKA.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to KSKA.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.